Hi everyone, welcome. Thanks for coming tonight. So my name is Delushi, I'm one of the volunteer coordinators. And, there's a lovely group of people who make things happen, so really appreciate the help. If you have any questions at all throughout the evening, don't hesitate to find me. So these talks happen every Friday night. Do we have any new people here today? Welcome. We've got a newbie's guide, give some sort of general Q&A. Grab it from the stands over there. So I just acknowledge the Indigenous custodians. Okay, so I just acknowledge the Indigenous custodians of the lands that we're meeting on, the Cammeraygal people. I just pay my respects to their elders and acknowledge that they have an enduring connection to this land and have been here for a very long time. Just also some housekeeping, the toilets are just past the elevators. I have a mailing list and I do weekly reminders, so if you want to be on the mailing list, just come and find me. And it's usually Bunty Sujata giving these talks, we occasionally have guest speakers when he's away. So I can update you that on that in the emails. I think, yeah, I'll just introduce the speaker. So Bunte is a monastic of 30 years experience. He trained in the forest. He trained in the forest Thai forest meditation tradition, and he then trained under Ajahn Brahm in Perth as well. He was the abbot of Santi Forest Monastery for 10 years, and it's now a nun's monastery in the Southern Highlands. Highly recommend a visit. He also co-founded Sutta Central, and it has translations of early Buddhist teachings in both the original language and modern languages. And he spent a few years in Ireland off Taiwan translating the early Buddhist texts into contemporary English. A lot of the old translations are quite archaic, so it's amazing that we have that.
I just waited my people.
Speaking of those Sutta translations and Sutta Central, so our friends of the community, Tom and Ling Halbert, are doing a little project where you can actually purchase a set of the 28 books that Bunte's translated, so the early Buddhist texts, or donated for. So they've got a list of educational institutes and temples and things which were interested in this. So if you want to support the project, either donating some of the books or as a volunteer, just grab one of these or come talk to me. It's really fantastic to be able to print these for the local community, for Australian organisations. So it's a wonderful project. Please grab one if you're interested. That's all from me. Have an amazing evening. Chris, I can find me if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lucy.
Okay. So, welcome everyone. How are we all doing today? We're doing good? Everyone's good? Everyone's great? Really?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, what are you doing here then? We only want people who are suffering. If you're happy, you should be going out dancing. And I don't know. We're only on the miserable ones here. No, we want everybody, okay? Because we can, hopefully with Buddhism we can be happy, but we are still real. We still know that suffering is a reality in the world. Okay, so normally in these sessions we'll do some chanting. Is that with some chanting? Should we do that? What do you think? Okay, we're going to do some chanting. Who needs some chanting sheet? Do you need a chanting sheet? You have one? Have you done this chanting before?
Yes.
You have done it before. Excellent. Anyone who's never done Pali chanting before? You've never done Pali chanting before? Oh, that's incredible. That's so good that you have the opportunity to do this. Well, just very briefly, so Pali was the language that the Buddha spoke in. So it's about a 2,500-year-old Indian language, somewhat related to Sanskrit. And it's a language that the scriptures of Theravada Buddhism have been passed down from that time till today. And so that's our primary source for the understanding of like what the Buddha himself taught. So our translations are translations from Pali. Ishika, please come. And so in the Theravada tradition, then we maintain a practice of reciting our devotions in the Pali language. So sometimes we do chanting in translations as well. But with this group many years ago, I asked people whether they wanted to do the chanting in Pali or in English, and everyone said they wanted to do it in Pali. So that's why we do Pali. So that's good. And there's many nice things about this, but one of the nice things about this is that if you can get familiar with chanting the Pali, if you ever travel to any other temples, even in Sydney, honestly, but also overseas, if you go to Sri Lanka or India or Malaysia or Thailand, then they will be doing the same chanting in those places. So you can join, you'll be able to join, but small variations, but basically they'll be doing the same chanting. So this gives you an opportunity to learn and to be able to participate in the Buddhist tradition. And I can promise you that if you roll up at a Thai monastery or a Sri Lankan monastery and they start doing the chanting, especially if you're white and you roll up there and they do the chanting and you start chanting along, everyone will be like, wow, that's so impressive, okay? True? Yes, very true. When I was in Thailand when I was first ordaining, my mum came to visit me. My mum had spent some time in Laos, so she knew about all the kind of customs of doing anjali and bowing and these things. So and everyone was like so impressed. It's like, wow, your mum's really good, isn't she? I was like, yeah. No. Okay, let us begin. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagavā arahaṃ sammāsambuddho vijjācārana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi sattha deva manusana buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandirthiko akariko ehi pasiko opanayiko pachata vedita bu vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato sava sangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Nyayapatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Samichipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Iyaridam chatari purisa yugani artha purisa pungala esa bhagavato savaka sangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakireyo anjali karaniyo anuttaram punyaketam lokasati. Okay, very good. Excellent. All right, so shall we do some meditation? Yes?
Yes.
Yes. Anyone not want to do any meditation? Be honest. All right, let's do some meditation. Okay, so meditation is a pretty amazing practice. Like if I don't know, I feel like we live in a world where like religion, the whole idea of religion is becoming more and more questioned and more open in doubt, and people like rejecting things, and people like don't like to believe in things, whatever. And it's when we think about religion, like we think about institutions, we think maybe temples or all of these kinds of things. And we think about, people think about religion as like a kind of set of beliefs about God and so on and so forth, all of this kind of stuff. I don't know, whatever. But it's amazing to me how the central practice in Buddhism has nothing to do with any of those things. You just sit down and breathe. Sinsin, welcome. We were missing you. It was like the assembly was incomplete with Sinsin not here. Now we're complete. And meditation is the simplest practice in the world. You don't have to be Buddhist. You don't have to be anythingist. You have to be alive. I don't even know if that's technically true. If you're doing mindfulness of breathing, then you have to be alive. So, and it's such a simple practice and has so much benefit for so many people. And yet we simply breathe. We simply become aware of what we are doing already. It's impossible to imagine, to me, impossible to imagine anything that's simpler, anything that's, it's almost nothing at all. Just be aware of your breathing. And one of the most remarkable things about meditation is that such a simple practice has spawned so many books. I don't know. What are people putting in all of these books about meditation? I don't know. I've written books about meditation myself. I don't know. Why? It's very simple. You don't have to read any of those books. You don't have to listen to any of those talks or go to any of those courses. I mean, if you want to, that's fine. But actually, it's very, very simple. You sit and you breathe, and you just breathe mindfully. You bring awareness to it. When the Buddha was sitting under the Bodhi tree in Gaya, on the banks of Narantara River, he hadn't like done a 10-day course. He hadn't read like Eckhart Tolle or anything like that, okay? He found his way. Like he had teachers and he learned things from those teachers, obviously. But the practice of meditation is a practice that's of such astonishing simplicity. There's nothing to it. And yet, its potential for transformation is so vast. It's the same practice that we're going to be doing in just a few minutes. Same practice that the Buddha did on the night that he became enlightened. Same practice that the Buddha kept on practicing even after he was enlightened. Mindfully breathing in and mindfully breathing out. And so even though we tend to accumulate, you know, so many words around this practice, so many ideas, so many concepts, the reality is that the essence of that practice is attained with the least, with the minimum of things, the minimum of ideas that you bring to it, minimum of expectations, minimum of memories, minimum of anything. And pure and perfect mindfulness of breathing is just the awareness of the breath. Nothing could be simpler. Now, when practicing mindfulness of breathing, the number one thing that people say is that they say they're trying to pay attention to the breath, and their mind gets distracted, or all these thoughts coming in, and so on and so forth. Or they say somebody forgot to turn their phone off, and then that distracts them. So thank you for that little ding, reminding us about phones. That's like really important. We really appreciate that. But we've learned that lesson now. We don't need to learn it a second time. So you can turn your phone off or on silent, and that would be very appreciated. So all of these things that distract us, and one of the things that I've noticed about meditators is that they tend to be worried a lot more about the distractions than they are with the meditation. And they tend to think that they're not good meditators because they're getting too distracted. And I want to tell you that that doesn't mean, the fact that you're distracted doesn't mean you're a bad meditator. It doesn't mean you're not succeeding at meditation. It just means that's what meditation is. It means that's how your mind works. Don't worry about it. That's not your meditation. Your meditation is not worrying about things, worrying about your thoughts or your emotions or any of these kinds of things. Your meditation is being aware of your breath. And your breath will take care of all of those things for you. This is where we have faith. We bring that dimension of faith into the meditation. Patience. It's okay. Your breath will take care of you. You don't have to worry about it. So if you're feeling like meditation's a struggle, you're feeling like sometimes you're wasting your time, you're feeling like everything's all over the place, don't worry about that. Everyone feels like that sometimes. Just let the breath take care of it for you. There's no special tricks. There's no special methods or techniques or anything that you have to do. Just let the breath take care of you. And the more that you give yourself over to the breath and let the breath take care of you, then the more you'll find that your mind comes naturally to a state of peace. It is natural for the mind to be distracted when the conditions are there for the mind to be distracted. And it is natural for your mind to be at peace when the conditions are there for your mind to be at peace. That's all. Let's do some meditation. Okay, so sitting quietly, taking a couple of minutes to find that balance in your body with your back reasonably straight, your face relaxed, belly relaxed. Head tilted slightly forward. And when you feel ready, with a sense of ease and poise inside your body, bring attention to the gentle feeling of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Feeling that soft movement of the breath. As it calms you down. As it brings peace, through all your limbs, all the parts of your body. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Okay, now coming near the end of the meditation, I want you to reflect back to the beginning of the practice. Recall what your body was like at that time, what your mind was like at that time, what the breath was like at that time. And then recall how that changed. What were the things that were helping you and supporting you? And what were the things that were challenging you and obstructing you? And how is your mind now? Do you feel more peaceful, more relaxed? Remember that this is the result of your practice. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so let's have a break for a few minutes and we'll come back, grab a cup of tea, and then come back for the Dhamma talk. Excellent. Okay, so I wanted to give a bit of a talk for this evening on the topic of truth. And I just want to say hi to folks online. How are you going? How's cyberspace going? It's good. Mike, Tessa, Sumana, good to see you. Venerable Pasanna, excellent. Martina, Marion, Daniel, how's it going, Dan? Good to see you. Amanda, good to see you. How's things? Okay, so Colin Bellingen, does that mean that you're in Bellingen? Or you're called Bellingen? Well, the mysteries of existence. Anyway, if you're in Bellingen, I hope you're enjoying it. I'll be up in Coffs tomorrow as it happens, so we'll be more or less neighbours. Anyway, moving along. So the topic of truth. And I had a couple of passages that I wanted to read for you on that topic, and also a story. And just briefly, just to say a couple of things about truth. So we know what truth is, right?
Kind of.
Good enough. Okay, so keeping truth and speaking truthfully obviously is the foundation of right speech. And within the Buddhist tradition, speaking of truth has a special place among the precepts because the act of speaking is the act of making sense, making meaning, and the conveying of wisdom and the conveying of understanding. When we speak lies and when we speak in a way that is delusional, we are increasing the delusion of others. Right? We are actually amplifying moha, amplifying delusion, and amplifying ignorance every time that we speak a lie, every time we speak an untruth. So this is something which directly goes against the Buddha's teachings, which is all about the realization of the truth. So it's often said in Buddhist tradition that throughout all of his many past lives, as told in the Jataka stories, that the Bodhisattva broke all of the four precepts, but he didn't break the precept on lying. Has anyone heard that saying before? Maybe it's only a Thai thing. I've heard that when I was in Thailand. So they say the Bodhisattva broke all four precepts, but not the precept on lying. Unfortunately, that's not true. Ironically enough, that's not actually true. Because he did actually lie in the Jataka stories. He was learning, right? But it does give you an idea of how significant that the telling of truth is to the Buddhist tradition. Of course, the four realization of the Dhamma is realization of the four noble truths, and aligning ourselves with reality is really important. So I'm going to give some reflections about that as we go on, but I wanted to read a couple of passages on the truth. So, and just give a bit of background for those who are interested. First passage is from the Middle Discourses, the Majjhima Nikaya. I'll give a bit of a summary. Buddhists have scriptures. From the Theravada tradition, our scriptures are in Pali. Other traditions have scriptures in other languages, but the early texts are more or less similar. But the Pali tradition, we have the Tripitaka, three baskets. And the suttas, the discourses, Vinaya is the monastic discipline, and the Abhidhamma is the treatise. So we're going to leave those two aside for now. And we've got the suttas. That's what this is. This is one of the books in the suttas. Suttas consist of four main nikayas, which is mostly prose texts, and a smaller nikaya, which is actually bigger, called the Kudaka Nikaya, okay, mostly verses. All right, and so this is four nikayas, long, middle, connected, and linked discourses and numbered discourses, okay? And we are today looking at the middle discourses. That's this one here. So we've gone from the Tripitaka to the suttas, and the suttas, we have the four nikayas, and we're now looking at the middle discourses here, and this is the middle discourse number 66, I think it is, 66 or 61, what is it? So the 152 in the middle discourses, this is 61. Okay, so that's where we are in the canon. All right. I was thinking about today, I think I was looking at a particular line in the Therigata in one of the books in the canon. I was just revising it and so on. I'm thinking, that's incredible. I can't believe I've actually translated all of these things. It's completely ridiculous. How did I do that? I don't know. I don't know. Oh, what's going on? Anyway. I have this theory that if we really knew how hard it was to do anything, we'd never do anything. like I've never been married, right? But if you knew how hard marriage was, would you still do it? I don't know. I don't know. If you're going to build a house, would you do it if you knew how much it was going to cost and all of those things? I don't know. I think we have a mechanism that lies to us, tells us it's going to be fine, it's not going to be that bad, And that's good. It's good that that's there, because otherwise we'd never do anything. Yeah. Anyway. Okay, fine. So Majjhima Nikaya number 61, the Ambalaptika Rahulo Vada Sutta. Okay. The Buddha was staying near Rajagaha in the bamboo grove in the squirrel's feeding ground. Has anyone been to Rajagaha? Yes, been there? Been today to Rajagiri? You can still go there. There's very spectacular hills and so on you can go around. And did you go to the bamboo grove, the Welawana? Did you see the gum trees there? They have eucalyptus. They have eucalypts growing there. It feels like going home. Yes, you remember? Yeah, I obviously had a thing. Anyway, so they've upgraded from bamboo grove to gum tree grove. Sorry? No? Okay, fine. Okay, so the Buddha's staying there. It's one of the very common monasteries that the Buddha used to stay at. Now, at that time, Venerable Rahula was staying at Ambalatika. So this was like a little place that monastics could stay at. Sometimes it was obviously close by to the bamboo grove. Then in the late afternoon, the Buddha came out of retreat and went to Ambalatika to see Venerable Rahula. Oh, by the way, who's Rahula? The Buddha's son, okay. And according to tradition, he ordained while he was still quite young. And this particular sutra is taught to him while he was still young. He's probably a teenager at this point. Rahula saw the Buddha coming off in the distance. He spread out a seat and placed water for washing the feet. The Buddha sat on the seat spread out and washed his feet. Rahula bowed to the Buddha and sat down to one side. And the Buddha, leaving a little water in the pot, addressed Rahula. Rahula, do you see this little bit of water left in the pot? Yes, sir. That's how little of the ascetic's nature is left in those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie. Then the Buddha, tossing away what little water was left in the pot, said to Rahula, do you see this little bit of water that was tossed away? Yes, sir. That's how the ascetic's nature is tossed away in those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie. Then the Buddha, turning the pot upside down, said to Rahula, do you see how this pot is turned upside down? Yes, sir. That's how the ascetic's nature is turned upside down in those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie. Then the Buddha, turning the pot right side up, said to Rahula, do you see how this pot is vacant and hollow? Yes, sir. That's how vacant and hollow the ascetic's nature is in those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie. When someone is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, there is no bad deed they would not do, I say. So you should train like this. I will not tell a lie, even for a joke. So that's as far as I'll take that passage for this particular sutta. So we've learned a few interesting things along the way there. First of all, you can see the Buddha's teaching techniques, right? So he's teaching a kid, and so he's using the cup and giving an illustration, turning it upside down. It's a memorable lesson, right? And it shows that one of the many examples, and it shows how the Buddha adapted his teaching for a different audience. That's one thing. So the other thing the Buddha is talking about, the nature of the ascetic's life, the samanya, right? So the nature of the ascetic's life. So this is the nature of somebody who's a sincere practitioner of the Dhamma, and talking about how dependent that is on the truth. And it's a pretty strong statement, right? Somebody who would, there's nothing that bad that they wouldn't do. If you tell a deliberate lie, there's nothing bad that you wouldn't do. It's a pretty challenging statement, yeah? So I'm not going to kind of defend it here, but I'm just going to say that this illustrates what I was saying before about how central and how important the notion of teaching truth is. Now, the point that it made there about you're not allowed to tell a lie even as a joke. Okay, so we're going to need to pass this out a bit, because otherwise some monks are going to be in a lot of trouble. I'm not going to say who those monks are. But you all know who I'm talking about, apart from me. So what does that mean? That you mean that you can't even tell a joke? So what if I was to say a monk a rabbi and a priest walked into a bar. See, I didn't even tell the punchline, right? And you're already laughing, okay? Now, so in that case, that's not actually telling a deliberate lie. Why? Because I'm not trying to make you believe that that actually happened. It's obviously the setup for a joke. So if you that's not telling a deliberate lie. What telling a lie as a joke would be something like, I don't know, just think of an example would be something like, let's say if I'm a monk, I come down in the morning, they say there's a rain or something like that. And, you know, I see my friend there and I say, oh, shame that you left your laundry out today. And then your friend says, no, I didn't leave my laundry out. He says, you sure? Pretty sure I saw your laundry left out. And he thinks, oh, no, I left my laundry out, and then runs back to his kutty to check his laundry but didn't leave his laundry out, right? So in that case, you've actually made him believe that he left his laundry out, right? So you have actually lied to him. Okay, it is funny, but but not appropriate, right? So that's what it means by telling a lie as a joke. You still have to tell a lie, right? So you still have to deliberately create, but your aim is to deliberately make somebody believe something that isn't true. All right. So don't get, one of the points about this is don't get too paranoid about it. And I'm going to be coming back to that point a little bit later. So that centrality of lying, okay, is, I think, really important. And it's something which I think is often overlooked in Buddhism or in the world. Like I feel today that we are subject to a massive tsunami of lies all the time. And we have huge disinformation machines like AI. AI is an industrial manufacturer of lies on a scale that we have never, ever seen before, and we're not prepared to cope with. And what can we do about this? Well, one thing we can do is to hold on to the truth and to hold on to that really well. And that means things like don't share memes without fact-checking them first, all right? Don't share information without fact-checking it first, yeah? All of these simple kinds of things, just have a bit of discipline and make sure to stick with the truth, whatever that we're doing. The more that we become swamped in an ocean of lies, then the more valuable and precious those few patches of truth that still remain. It's one of the reasons why sort of central, we said no AI in sort of central, like all of our repos, all of our translations are completely free of any AI content. I won't have anything to do with that stuff. So moving on. Okay, so now I'm going to give a bit of a reading from the Vinaya. Now, I mentioned before about the three baskets, okay? The suttas, there's the discourses. So that's mostly what we read and study. So most of the interesting stuff is in the suttas. The Vinaya is the monastic discipline. And actually, Vinaya has a lot of really interesting things in it. Some of it is not that interesting, admittedly. It's like just procedures and legalities and so on. But it has a lot of fascinating details about day-to-day life. There's a lot of terminology and ideas that you don't find really anywhere else. And it often breaks down issues, like in this case, lying, in ways that are more detailed than we find in the suttas. So this we're going to be reading from is the Vinaya. Again, just to give some sort of background and some context, in the Vinaya we have, say, three main sections, a section of rules for the monks, rules for the nuns, and rules for the khandakas, which are procedures and various other duties and so on. So we're going to be reading from one of the rules for the monks. The rules for the monks are divided into a number of categories. Parajika is the defeat. That means that if you commit that, you're finished. Okay? Parajika. Yeah. So that means if you do something serious, so for example, murder. Okay? If you're a monk, you go and murder someone, then you're out. You can't be a monk again. That's it. Theft. Anyway. So then Sangha Disesa is the next one, also for serious things, but there you can be rehabilitated from which you can be rehabilitated. So they include a variety of things. For example, trying to side with somebody who's causing a schism, okay, would be one of them. Or, for example, building code violations, okay, various things like that. Then we have another one, which is the Anyata rules. Anyata rules are very interesting. I might have spoken about these before. Anyata rules are a pair of rules which essentially enforce that a monk must believe the word of a trustworthy laywoman if she makes an allegation of sexual misconduct against a monk. So if a woman comes along and says, that monk groped me, that monk did this, monk did that, then the Sangha has to act according to the words of that trustworthy laywoman, even if the monk denies it. This is the only rule in the entire Vinaya where the confession of the monastic is not required. The only case, it's an exception. Okay, so this is the Anyata rule. Then there's the Nisagya Pachitya rule. The Nisagya Pachitya rules involve giving something up. So they involve some kind of object, okay? Maybe it's money, okay? So monastics are not supposed to receive money. Someone gives us money, right? What do we do? Okay, so we have a procedure. There's a whole procedure around that. You have a meeting of the Sangha. You confess it. You give it. And then the Sangha appoints a money thrower away. And that's the a money thrower away. That's the only time that you're allowed to legitimately pick up money as a monk, okay, or a nun. You have, and so that when that's done, you they take the money, then they have to walk out into the forest, turn around, and throw it over their shoulder, and then not. If they turn around to look where it falls, then that's an offense, okay. So that's. That's the money throwing away, right? So there are various things like that that we have to relinquish. So, for example, like if we've got too many robes might be another example or things like that. So we've got some object that needs to be given up. So, and then finally, or not finally, but then we have the Pachitya rules which require confession, okay? So these range from things that actually are very serious. So, for example, let's say I was to get into fisticuffs with a monk. Okay, I was to get into a fight, beating each other up. That's a Pachitya offense. That's obviously pretty serious and obviously not something that generally speaking is a good idea for monks and nuns to be doing as a rule. But it's a Pachitya, but all the way to very minor things. Right? So a lot of very, very small things, like if I have a robe size that is too big or something like that, that also is considered to be a Pachitya offense. So it's a very broad, encompassing. So there are other categories, but these are the main ones. I won't bore you too much. Anyway, the first of the Pachitya offences is the rule on lying. Sambhajana Musava De Pachitya. It gives an indication of significance. Now, it can't be, remember that the Buddha said that, you know, if you're going to tell a deliberate lie, you've thrown away your ascetic's nature. And yet it doesn't mean that actually you can't continue as a monk. Like it's not, like in terms of Vinaya discipline, it's not so serious. You can just confess it and then you're okay. And so the Vinaya is a very pragmatic document because obviously it's very easy to tell a lie. And if you kicked every monk out who told a lie, the ranks of the Sangha would be a lot thinner, right? So you have to confess it. So how we do this is when you do that, you confess it to another monk or another nun. The confession does not happen hierarchically, right? You confess to anyone. Everyone is completely equal when we do the confessions. And you have to name the offense. You have to name when you did it. You have to name the specifics. You have to say, this is what I did, this is what I said, and this is the kind of offense that it is. All right. Anyway, so that's just a bit of a background on the Vinaya and how the Vinaya works. Now, each one of the Vinaya rules, so there are 92 Pachitya offenses, and each one has different sections. So you can just see here that there's different sections in here, right? So the suttas, you usually just have like one flow, like the Buddha's talking and so on, whereas this you have like different sections. The sections usually are the background story, tells how the rule came to be, the rule itself, list of definitions of terms, then different kinds of permutations and refinements. Sometimes there are second laying downs, modifications of the rule. Then there are various non-offense clauses, ways of getting out of being able to give the offense. So these are typically how the Vinaya rules are structured. Anyway, I'll read the background story. Hatika the Sakyan was beaten in debate. I'm not sure who Hatika was. He probably doesn't appear very much, but the Sakyans, of course, were the Buddha's family. And I'm just going to come out and say it. They were bad. Like, there's a lot of bad Sakyans in the Sangha. Not just one or two, quite a few of them. It's a whole thing. Okay, Hatika the Sakyan was beaten in debate. There were also good Sakyans, by the way, like the Buddha, for example. Hatika the Sakyan was beaten in debate. While talking with monastics of other religions, he would assert things after denying them, and he would deny things after asserting them. He evaded the issues, lied, and made sham appointments. The monastics of other religions complained and criticized him. And Hatika talks with us. How can he assert things after denying them? Deny things after asserting them, evade the issues, lie, and make sham appointments. The monks heard the complaints of those monastics of other religions. They then went to Hatika and they asked him, is it true that you're doing this? And Hatika said, these monastics of other religions need to be beaten, whatever it takes. They shouldn't be allowed to win. So the monks of few desires complained and criticized him. And after rebuking him in many ways, they told the Buddha. Soon afterwards, the Buddha had the Sangha gathered and questioned Hatika. Is it true, Hatika, that you're doing this? It's true, sir. The Buddha rebuked him. Foolish man, how can you do this? This will affect people's confidence. And monks, this training rule should be recited like this. If a monk lies in full awareness, he commits an offense entailing confession. All right, so that's the background story leading up to the laying down of the rule. So what do we think about Hatika's behavior? Do we agree with him that we've got to beat those other guys no matter what happens? Sounds like your colleagues. Main thing is winning, right? Yeah. I don't know. So there was a whole, like at that time, there was a whole culture of debating. And actually there's many suttas which talk about this. And there's obviously were a lot of people who had that kind of attitude, right? They were in it to win it, right? So you were going to get there, you were going to point out all the flaws in their arguments and so on and so forth, and then prove your own supremacy by beating somebody in debate. And this is the kind of thing that the Buddha, of course, was very critical of. Not to say that he would not enter into debate, okay? But when you're entering into debate, the purpose is not to defeat the other person. The purpose is to bring out the truth and to find the truth. And it's one of the Buddha's strategies, which is really noteworthy, is that whenever he was talking to someone, even if they were antagonistic, the first thing he would do would be to establish common ground. Find something that you can agree on with that person. And that gives you a place that you can start. Doesn't mean you're always going to agree about everything, but it means you've got a place to start from. And this is a pattern in the Buddha's conversations you see repeated countless times. But also interesting to see how the Buddha dealt with this particular issue. So when this was going on, people complained about it. They brought the complaints to the Buddha. The Buddha asked the Sangha there, and then asked the monk there and said, is this true? Okay, this is really important. Notice how he manages the Sangha. He's not like doing it off to the side in some closed room. He's not like hiding things. It's out in the open. Everything is transparent. And he doesn't make any assumptions based on rumors or anything like that. Okay, he asks, is this true? And first establish the facts of the matter. If you can't do that, there's not really a lot that you can do in terms of resolving the issue. So imagine, I want you to put yourself in Hatika's shoes for a minute there. What would that be like? So first of all, you've been out there as a Dhamma warrior beating those other guys, right? You feel like you're righteous, you're good, you'd be doing all those things, and then the Buddha calls you and you're like, and the Buddha says, is this true? I've got to imagine that you're feeling a bit nervous by that point. So um, So then after doing that, then the Buddha lays down the rule. Now, the rule definition has some interesting details. One of the interesting details is it talks about what it means to be deliberate or in full awareness to tell the lie. Before he has lied, he knows he's going to lie. While lying, he knows he is lying. And after he's lied, he knows he has lied. Okay, so that's what it means to do it in full awareness. Okay, so that's a fairly strong set of criteria, right? You know beforehand, you know during it, and you know afterwards that you're lying, okay? So again, this is from a Vinaya point of view. So for the Vinaya wants to make things as clear as possible. And the Vinaya is always trying to get people out of having an offense, okay? So the Vinaya is not trying to legislate everything. It wants to give you an out as much as possible, right? It's the Buddha's trying to be as gentle as possible. But if these three characteristics are fulfilled, then the offense falls. If not all of them are fulfilled, it'd be a more minor offense, okay? So those three characteristics, you know beforehand, you know while it's going on, and you know afterwards, yeah? So this is an interesting way of understanding the idea of full awareness, okay? Then there are also some non-offense clauses that are interesting. So each of the Vinaya rules finishes with a series that tell you, you know, how you can get out of it or where the rule does not apply. Okay, there are two universal conditions. One is if you are out of your mind. Okay, so if you're insane, then you cannot break any Vinaya rules, okay? So this is a bit similar to a modern legal context. So by what it means, what being insane means in that case is probably what we would call a psychotic episode. So you basically don't have any awareness of what you're doing, you don't have any memory of it afterwards, you've got no control over your impulses and so on. So that's... if you're insane, so you can do whatever you like. And the number one is if you are the first offender, okay? So the rule hasn't been laid down and you can't be convicted for something that has not been laid down, okay, fine. So in other words, you can get away with anything as long as there's no rule against it. If you want to think of it that way, I'm not saying you should think of it that way. I'm just saying that one could think of it that way. Okay, then there are a couple of also non-offense clauses that are specific for this particular rule. Number one, if you speak playfully, okay, teasing or something like that. If you speak too fast, right, so sometimes you can say something incorrect but you're not really thinking through. Speaking too fast, meaning to say one thing, he says another. So these are some of the non-offense clauses. So this is the rule about lying. There are other rules that cover the same topic from different perspectives, but that's like the basic rule about lying in the Vinaya. So I want to go on to discuss another passage, but I just before we go on, are there any questions about that so far? Yeah. Go on.
What? But then it says you can lie playfully.
You can lie playfully, yeah. So I think that's like that distinction that I was saying before. So like you're speaking playfully, but you're not like deliberately making a lie. So think about that example where you're deliberately lying to someone saying, oh, your laundry is out. You know before you say it that it's not true. You know while you're saying it, it's not true. And you know afterwards that is while your friend is running out in the rain to check his laundry, which isn't out, you know it's not true, right? Well, when a monk, a priest, and a rabbi walk into a bar, right? So again, you're not fulfilling all of the categories of being a liar.
How about someone
saying,
"Good morning"?
Like late for a talk in the evening, you mean? And they say, "Good morning." Yeah, that's not a lie because you're not making a statement of fact, I guess. Yeah. It does get complicated. Yes, pay.
Yeah,
Okay. If you're organizing a surprise birthday party for someone, well, I don't think it's a surprise anymore. Okay, so is organizing a surprise birthday party, are you allowed to lie when doing that? So I would say you can probably try to find ways around it, right, without actually lying about it.
That's lying.
Not necessarily. You're not lying. Right. Look, there are ways. There are ways of talking. So you're asking me how to lie about things. So look, in that kind of case, I mean, that's actually a refreshing example, because usually, like, when people talk about white lies, they're talking about something that's really important. But in this case, it's more or less just for fun. But look, just try your best and try to figure out a way of talking that isn't going to be lying. Okay, so I'll just give you one example. When I was at Bodhnyana, we had there was one time where there was one monk who was there who was being kind of harassed by somebody who kept on ringing every day and asking for him. And he was trying to get away from this person. And anyway, we were up there having a cup of tea, and then we had a system. And then when that person rang, then one of the secretary monk would answer the phone. And when he knew that there was that person, and then that monk would jump up and then run out of the room. And then they'd say, oh, look, I think he's just gone. Yeah. True statement. So, sorry? It's not entirely straightforward, but it's not a lie. Yeah.
What do you say is a joke that somebody actually believes it because they're just not that?
Well, if many such cases, yes. If you say it as a joke, but someone believes it because they're not that smart, that's many such cases. Particularly happens online, actually, because people don't have the context to be able to understand humour and sarcasm and so on.
Like they're not used to the Aussie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. That's right. Yeah. So again, it's about your intention. If you don't have the intention to mislead, then you should be okay. So there's a passage in the Lotus Sutra. So Lotus Sutra is a Mahayana sutra. It's written about maybe 700-800 years after the Buddha, and which sort of makes a case for white lies. And so it gives a sort of classic simile of a house which is burning down. So the house is burning down. There's some children trapped in the house. Okay. So first of all, notice how it's constructing this story. Okay. You're already empathizing. There's children in a burning house. Oh no, right? So you'd have to be cruel and heartless not to want them to get out of the house. Okay. You call to them, come out, but they don't come out. Oh no, what's happening to these poor children? So then what do you do? You say to these children, oh, I have toys for you. I have toy cars. You can come and play with those toy cars when you come out. And they think, oh yeah, play with toy cars. So they come out, but you don't actually have any toys. So is that justifiable? So according to the Lotus Sutra, then that kind of white lie is justifiable. Interesting. You can buy them toys afterwards, but you've already said, I've got them toys. You could. I don't know, like, I honestly don't think you'd be particularly fazed about those details at the time. So this is something which has been introduced into the Mahayana tradition like that. It's one of those kind of differences. Like, generally speaking, when you look at the ethical principles across Buddhist tradition, they're actually all the same. But this is like one detail where you do kind of notice that in Mahayana Buddhism, there is a more explicit acceptance of the idea that there can be white lies, which you don't find in early Buddhism at all. Like, there's no There's no passage, no nothing that allows that idea of a white lie. But what gives that context in the Lotus Sutra is like what they were trying to do dogmatically. So the Lotus Sutra gave the simile, the toy cars, that's in fact the Hinayana, right? So that's actually early Buddhism, is the toy cars. So this is what the Buddha was doing. He was teaching you these toy vehicles, but what he really wanted to give you was the Mahayana, the great vehicle, right? So it's actually developing a rhetorical strategy for its doctrinal position, which is that the Mahayana supersedes the early Buddhist teachings, right? So again, I don't want to get into that too much, but I just want to say that you do find these kinds of things in the Buddhist tradition, but you don't find them in the early Buddhist tradition. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, what if telling the truth causes is going to possibly cause harm, and so you tell a little white lie?
Okay. So what if the truth is going to cause harm, and so you tell a little white lie? So when I was in... some years ago, someone came to me, a gentleman came to me, he was in tears. He'd been on a business trip, met this ex of his, and they'd had a quick fling. He came back home and he was so despairing that he'd betrayed his wife. He said he loved his wife, he just wanted to be with her. And he said, but I can't tell her because it would hurt her too much. And I'm like, you already took her volition away from her when you decided to betray her, and now you're doing it again. And it's her decision if she's going to be hurt or not. And what her response is not your decision, having done something bad already, to then lie and then take her volition away again. So if you're going to say something that's going to hurt somebody, it's sometimes those things need to be said. And if it needs to be said, that's okay. It's not your intention. You can soften it as much as possible. But to tell a lie in service of those things is often to do a disservice to a person because it takes away their, what I'm looking for, their ability to determine their own response. It's a lot tougher when it comes to children.
Yes.
You have to lie to children, do you? When they're little, they ask, like, what's mummy and daddy doing in the bedroom?
Maybe intention comes into play there because, I mean, sometimes you tell white lies with the kids.
Mm, So what about children? Do we tell white lies to children to make it nicer for them? Look, this is a complicated area. And personally, as a monk, I would like to say that the last thing I want to do is to go around judging parents for their choices making parenting, because parents already have a bloody hard job and I cannot believe that they managed to get through it. So if they manage to get through it, all power to them, and I'm not going to do anything to criticize that. The Buddha did talk about deeds that are both black and white, that lead to both black and white results. So if you're telling a lie, then that's a dark deed. You're doing something which is creating delusion. But if your intention is to do something good, then that's white. So you can ask yourself whether that's good, whether that's justifiable or not. Yeah? Yeah, I mean, there are things that we say that are playful, right? Like we talk about like Father Christmas or something like that. But, I'm going to leave that one just for now. This obviously is a complex issue. Father Christmas. Okay. Okay, so now, next one I'm going to tell just a little story. And this is something that I encountered along the way when I was doing a bit of research for this talk, and it's Jataka story number, I think, 444. I'm not going to read it. I'm going to just riff off it, okay, so don't quote me on this. Okay, so it's a Jataka story, the Kanhadipayana Jataka, and it goes something like this. There was an ascetic named Kanhadipayana. It means the dark light. Cool name, right? Right? Cool name. So Kanhadipayana was a family that he used to know and he used to visit, and they had something of like a, I guess, like an Airbnb or something like that. Travelers used to stay there and things like that. And one time he was at this family's house. There was a husband and wife and a son, Yanyadatta. And when they were at the, he was at the house, and Yanyadatta was playing and disturbed the snake and got bitten. Son is lying there, dying, snake venom, right? Obviously, they don't have such good medicines and so on. They did what they could, but it wasn't working. So they asked the monk, can you help? What can you do? And the monk said, okay, well, I'll do an asseveration of truth. And through that means that that's the best I can do for your son. So this idea, an asseveration of truth, is a cultural idea in ancient India. If you say a truth that is true enough, then it has almost like a magical power, okay? And in this particular one, so the monk says, I'm going to tell this asseveration of truth, okay? So the monk's, what's the monk's truth is this. That I've been a monk for 50 years. For the first 7 days after I renounced, my life was full of joy and peace. Everything else has been a bloody slog. I've hated every minute of it. I've been a monk for 50 years and only 7 days I actually enjoyed. That's my truth. And when he said that, the boy recovered. But only a bit. He was still sick, only partially recovered. The monk said, obviously, that's not enough. We need more truth. So he said to the father, well, come on, what have you got? He said, okay. Father said, okay. He said, look, here I am. Everybody knows me as this generous person because travelers and wayfarers come by this place and I give them a place to stay. I give them food and I look after them. He says, but I hate it. I'm like, why am I giving you my stuff? Go away and leave me alone. I hate being generous. I'm not generous because I care for these people or I want to be generous. I'm only generous because my dad did it and my grandfather did it, and so everyone will criticize me if I stop doing my family tradition. That's my truth. So then the boy started to recover. It got even better, but still not completely good. So they said to the wife, okay, it's up to you. You've got to give us one. She said, okay, look, this is really hard to say, okay, but I'm going to have to say my deep truth. She said, if I look at that snake, that dead snake that has just bitten my son, and I look at my husband, I don't love one more or less than the other. I have no more feeling for my husband than I do for that dead snake that just bit my son. And when she said that, then the boy sprang up and was good as new. Did you just make it up? No, it's Jataka 444. Kamhadipayana Jataka. Yeah, you can check. Did I just make it up? Like I said, this is not literally word for word what it says, okay? But it's the gist of the story, all right? Did I just make it up? Come on. So then the boy was better. Now the boy is better. And so then they asked. Then the husband had said to the monk, like, why do you keep going? Like, why did you spend 50 years in robes if you just hated it the whole time? He said, what else am I going to do? You know, I became a monk and everyone's going to, if I disrobe, now everyone's going to criticize me and so on. So I just kept at it because I couldn't think of another option. It's kind of sad, isn't it? Yeah. And then he said, well, to the husband, like, why are you doing what you do? He said, well, you know, I'm just sort of stuck here. This house was given to me by my father and I just like had to do the duties of the family. So I just like had to do it. Otherwise everyone would have criticized me. And they asked the wife, like, why do you stick it out in this marriage? She said, well, what options do I have, you know? What am I going to do, go and get married again or leave? I mean, I, as a woman, I don't have those options. So I just thought I'll stick it out and just, you know, do the best. And so there was something about that story which really struck me. Like, it's very modern. Like, I'm feeling like everyone around you is just going through their lives, secretly hating it and finding it meaningless. And then somehow, until there is some crisis, that draws out the truth, right? Draws out the truth like the viper's venom was drawn out of the boy, right? But also interesting symbolically, right? When that boy is growing up in a house of lies, he becomes poisoned. And the child is actually poisoned with that lies, yeah? That's really interesting. I thought that was a really interesting motif in this. And so at the end of it, they all resolved. The husband said, "You should," to the monk, he said, "you should be grateful to be a monk. It's a beautiful life. You get to live simply and peacefully. So be joyful and be glad and to live and to practice as a monk." And the monk said to the husband, he said, "And you, I want to reflect on the virtues of generosity and what people can do for each other. Here, you've seen this already. Your son has recovered. We know how that generosity and sharing is going to be creating good karma that's going to benefit us in the future." And the wife said to the husband, "I'm so sorry, my dear. I pretended that I loved you, but I didn't. And I just want to be really." I was just being honest because to save my son. And the husband said to the wife, "Ehi Bhadda, come, my dear, leave that in the past. There's nothing to forgive, and let us live and be happy together." And so after that, the husband and wife were happy and loving together as well. So that's the story. Oh, that's the Kanha Dipayana Jataka, number 444. Yes, I took some liberties, but that's the but that's the basic story. Huh? And so one of the things which to me was really moving about that story is it shows the emotional resonance of the truth. It's not just getting your facts right, but it's about trust and it's about a connection with people. It's about knowing that there is that what there is between that group of people is something that's based on reality and it's not based on lies, not based on hiding. And that, to me, my mind was like really moving in that simple little story. So that's the Kanha Dipayana Jataka story. So as I said at the beginning, like we do live in an age of lies. I mean, an age where lies are being manufactured on an industrial scale and being distributed en masse around the world. So hold fast to the truth. Make an effort for the truth. Make an effort. And don't let yourself get swamped up in lies. Don't let yourself get swamped up in conspiracy theories and all of the kind of nonsense that's swirling around the world. Whatever truth that we can find is something that's incredibly precious. And remember that truth is not just something that guards our virtue, but it's also liberatory. It leads to freedom. It leads to release from suffering. So that's a few words for today on the truth. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'm not sure. Do you have a question, Jenna? No. Oh, no, you just had your hand up. One question, go on. Please.
When you were talking about the monk that was asserting and then denying.
Oh, right, yeah, Hataka. Yeah.
Was that the part that was a lie?
Right, so he'd say this is A, and then afterwards he'd say this is not true, and so on, yeah.
So that was the lie?
Yeah.
Not knowing which one was the truth.
No. He would say, you know, the Buddha taught X, and then he'd say, oh, the Buddha didn't teach X, and so on. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Because isn't
that
kind of a thing where
the Buddha does that a bit sometimes? What do you mean?
Or was it not the Buddha? But maybe it was Dogen.
I'm not sure what you mean. What kind of thing?
No, and then he answers yes to the same question.
Ah, it's the same question. Yeah, that's the kind of thing. Yeah, but that's that's true. But then that's not kind of lying as such, because he's talking about different levels of reality or different seeing ways of seeing the same thing. So the purpose of that is not to create delusion, but to open up delusion, to be able to see the beneath the surface by making you ask more deeply. Yeah. That monk was lying, yes. Hataka was lying, yeah. Yeah. Please, Fabiola.
With the story of the child.
Yes.
It takes my attention that probably the husband and the wife, they were not telling a lie, but they were living a lie.
Right.
They were not hiding, but they were not living their truth.
Right.
But they were not telling a lie to anyone, which is hiding.
Maybe. I mean, she probably said, I love you to him, and that kind of thing. Right?
Yeah. But, what takes my attention is to living their truth, to live in our truth.
Right.
Like, right. Not just say it, but to live.
To live in it, right? And that's something that's something that's more than just avoiding lies, right? That's actually taking that step of, that's... And I think that's what that story was really talking about, right? An essential step towards being able to live your truth. Yeah. Okay. Last one.
In today's modern world, it's actually really hard. Like, you know, when you want to sign up for anything, there's this whole 17 pages of terms and conditions. I've read and understood this terms and conditions and then design. So,
are you saying that to a human being? Are you saying that to a human being?
No, like, you know how when you sign up for something...
I understand. You're signing up for something. You've got to say, I've read this boilerplate. Yeah. But are you saying that to a human being?
No.
The system. If you're not saying it to a human being, it's not a lie. I'm not saying you should do it, right? But you're not trying to create a false belief in someone. So it doesn't technically fall under a lie. It's not legal advice, by the way, for which you... Again, I'm not saying that those things are okay. I'm saying whether they fall under the technical definition of being a lie in this particular case. Yeah, in that case, that would definitely be a lie. But look, I get your point, though. I mean, you want to try to... do that. I remember I gave a talk in Singapore once, and then they were all like laughing because they all basically lie. But there was a parking ticket thing that they do where they can pretend that they're parking or not parking or something, and then everyone's like, oh yeah, we all do that. And I don't know. So yeah. Right. Yeah. Just beforehand it's going to be a lie, you know, meet during it and you know afterwards. And you have to be deliberately wanting to induce a false belief in somebody. Yeah. So.
Because
the consequences, right? Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. Let me just briefly, we've got to leave in a minute because of respect for the people here, but a couple of comments on the online very briefly. Oh, there's actually quite a few. So somebody asked, in which Jataka story did the Bodhisattva lie? There's actually a few of them. I can't remember off the top of my head. Does the Sotapanna automatically keep Vinaya? Generally speaking, yes. I'll definitely keep the major precepts. They might break minor precepts. Lie and denial are similar, sure. Michael gives an example about the difference between that if somebody not telling a deliberate lie appears to allow your interlocutor to believe a falsehood if you just choose true statements. So you're allowing your interlocutor to believe a falsehood. Huh? So, yeah, and he gives a quote there. I think that's an interesting point. I won't go into it in detail, but, yeah, that's certainly the case. So that could be like your party planning thing, right? You know, somebody says, oh, you're just going to the shops or something, are you? And they don't actually think that you're planning their birthday party, but you don't disabuse them of that notion. Okay. Daniel mentions I'm going to miss out a couple of these. Sorry, a couple of the questions. These are all good questions, but a couple of them take a little bit of too much time to respond, I'm afraid. Okay. Right, so let's leave it at that. So thanks, everybody. For over the next month or so, I'm going to be away for some of the time. We will have substitute, we have other teachers here. So the event will continue. I'll be away in Broken Hill for a retreat. And then after that, I'll be getting back and I'll be going to Indonesia for about a week. So it'll be a bit back and forth for the next month or so. Nilushi, do you have anything to say?
Next week is the Santi nuns, the Ayurveda.
Okay, so next week will be one of the nuns from Santi, either Ayurkarunika or Ayurpeka will be down for the talk. So please do come along for that. We're very lucky to have them around. Any other events needed to be mentioned? Okay. And I also just want to mention very briefly that the dark week is not going to happen for the next probably couple of months because I'm going to be away. So sorry to all of you weirdos out there. Oh, look, if Venerable Prasanna wants to do a dark week, good on them. Get dark. But anyway, okay, that's it. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Mandy.
In Kong.
Somebody telling lies to create division within the group.
That's in the Sangha de Sesa rules. That's Sangha de Sesa 11 or something. I can give you the reference, but I don't have it with me right at the moment. Yeah.
Just email you?
Yeah. That would be, I can find it for you right now.
Good, that would be good.
Maya, see you soon. See you soon. Yes. Yeah. So these ones here. Causing a schism, siding with a schismatic. These are the two relevant ones for that, yeah. Okay? Good. Okay. Good. See you next time.